Well, this was the book I was supposed to give first.
Mm-hmm.
They sort of have formed some kind of a taster for the top-down reality, but that's fine. I guess, yeah, this is a bit of an old, a little bit of an old material, but there are some interesting open problems here. It's fairly concrete open problems, and people who do modeling of chiral algebras might actually be able to help me with it. So I thought, why not just, I'm coming here, why not just discuss some of these things? So I did this, these projects during my DPhil. Lionel Mason was my supervisor, and Tim Adamo was faculty at Edinburgh.
Okay, so the basic premise of the talk is actually fairly related to some of the stuff that Kevin has been doing with his approaches of using 2D chiral algebra techniques to compute form factors and scattering amplitudes in self-Julian bells. And one of the tiny open problems, I guess, is that is to repeat the same analysis in the case of GR, or at least in the case of self-dual GR. And that hasn't been immediately possible, so I'm going to discuss some of the older successes that I had with my supervisor before any of that came out, and hopefully we can make some connections. So the talk is going to be about something called Pfister sigma models. Let me begin with giving a sort of summary of the talk. So, summary that we will develop some kind of a sigma model-ish correspondence between a scalar HK or quaternionic scalar done shortened to QK manifolds of some 4K dimensionality and some 2D. Well, beta gamma system type chiral algebras living in Pfister space. The Pfister space was originally constructed by Roger Penrose for the study of four-dimensional gravity, but then it was generalized by many mathematicians like Salomon and, Hitchin and other people, many other people, to work in basically arbitrary-dimensional hyperkähler and quaternionic kähler settings. The punchlines of the talk will be, so punchline one will be that on-shell actions of these 2D chiral algebras, 2D on-shell actions, will compute kähler potentials in the hyperkähler case, and we'll compute Swan scalars, sometimes also known as Prigenovsky scalars, in the quaternion kähler case. So this is sort of a build-up to punchline two. It sort of helps in getting the amplitude punchline. The amplitude-ish punchline, which is relevant for physics, is that correlators, 2D correlators, will compute tree-level GR graviton MHV amplitudes. So I'll tell you what these words mean in due course. So basically, roughly speaking, you can compute some really physics-y objects like scattering amplitudes using correlation functions of these models. And the big picture hope is that this might give us some, this might secretly be acting as some kind of building blocks for holographic dualities that generate scattering amplitudes in flat spacetimes and asymptotically flat spacetimes, somewhat akin to what happens in ADS-CFT, where you have some 2D theory on living on S2, which could compute Witten diagrams in ADS-3. So I'll begin with a review. I'm going to go fairly quickly because you all are probably more mathematically advanced than me. But if someone doesn't know anything, please feel free to ask. I'm going to work in a slightly general setting, general dimensional, and then depending on how much time I have towards the end of the talk, I'll talk about four-dimensional scattering amplitudes. Okay, so review Pfister theory. Firstly, let me remind you what these manifolds are. So basically, we're interested in 4K dimensional Riemannian manifolds, n comma g. So n is a manifold, and g is a metric. So k is some number greater than or equal to 1. And basically, hyperkaline, quaternion, KLR are defined by their holonomy types. So you have a manifold with group in which the holonomy is contained, and the curvature type. I'll also write what this means in 4D. K equals 1. So basically, hyperkaline corresponds to a manifold whose curvature is contained in the holonomy SPK. And these are Ricci flat. In 4D, these correspond to what are known as self-dual vacuum metrics. Self-dual in the sense that half of their Weyl tensor vanishes. Their right moving Weyl tensor vanishes, or their left moving Weyl tensor vanishes. Quaternion Taylor is basically the same, but the holonomy group can be slightly larger. So the holonomy group is SPK mod SP1 mod Z2, basically quotienting out where the diagonal center. And these manifolds can be Einstein. So again, these conditions are generically true when these holonomy conditions hold. This is proven by Berger and some people who I forgot. Sorry, I should cite some people, but I forgot to write their names from Wikipedia. But these are all given on Wikipedia. These are ancient results. All right. And these correspond to self-dual Einstein and Fourier functions. So of course, at the end of the day, we'll be interested in scattering amplitudes in flat space, which is trivially going to be subdual vacuum, but we're going to scatter something called positive holistic gravitons, which sort of act like a bath of, which sort of generate a non-trivial vacuum metric on top of flat space. And we're going to extract amplitudes as some kind of series expansion and small parameters of that metric. As I said, the first part of the talk is basically just maths. So, such metrics these are naturally encoded and sometimes even found by means of crystal theory. Basically, you get some correspondence between Riemannian manifolds, Riemannian complex manifolds, 4K real dimensional manifolds, quaternionic Taylor spaces, and 2K plus 1 dimensional complex manifolds called Twister spaces. And I'm going to denote my space-time manifold by capital N, and I'm going to denote my twister space as P curly T. The notation P is basically a historical remnant of something called projective twister spaces, things like that. You don't need to worry about it. Okay, so this is the correspondence that we're going to use. So let me tell you what the twister spaces are. Fairly, just giving a summary. In the hyperkaler case, the hyperkaler manifold is holonomy SPK. You can show that implies that you have a triplet of covariantly constant complex structures in your space, which are usually denoted IJK, that form the quaternion algebra. So basically the same algebra as Pauli matrices. IJ equals JK equals KI equals IJK equals, oh, sorry, I squared equals J squared equals K squared equals IJK equals minus 1. So each of them are almost complex structures, the square root minus 1. And then there's a quaternionic relation, IJK equals minus 1, that equals some extra relations. And then the point is that not only do such manifolds have 3 complex structures, once they have 3, they have a sphere of complex structures. You can take any point, A, B, C, on the tree sphere, say on the unit tree sphere. Then the new complex subfield we call it Kerr-Leggett, defined by taking a linear combination of these three things, is also an integrable, covariantly constant complex structure. Basically, you can show that J squares to minus one because of this condition. So you get a two-sphere worth of complex structures, and then twisted space, PT, is just the sphere bundle on M, whose global sections are, say, this curly J type complex structures. So it basically gives you a sphere bundle for your beautiful and killer manifold. Again, if you came to my talk earlier in the week, then you would have seen some examples. Journey on Keller is basically the same. Now you don't get a two-sphere worth of complex structures, but you have that extra SP1 factor in your holonomy. So you can, and that SP1, the Lie algebra of that acts like endomorphisms of your tangent bundle. So you get SP1 is just SU2, so you have three generators in that. So you can call them IJK. You can take the generators to be in one-to-one correspondence with Pauli matrices. You can take them to satisfy the same, the same object. And basically, it gives you the same structure, but now PT will be the sphere bundle of almost complex structures that look like sphere bundle of sections of almost complex structures that look like linear combinations. Okay, any questions about these? Okay. The beautiful theorem is that this is a fairly classical theorem. If you define, you can define a canonical almost complex structure on twisted space. So this whole thing is twisted space. You can define a very natural canonical almost complex structure on the tangent spaces at each point in twisted space. You just take this to be the direct sum of the natural complex structure on the sphere, fiber, plus the complex structure associated to ABC. So let me call that J subscript ABC. And what the T.I. Hutchinson-Singer proved, and more generally Salomon and Penrose and Hitchin, Carlisle, Lindstrom, and Brodsek, I'm sure I'm pronouncing some of the names incorrectly, they proved that this is integrable. So this provides a genuine complex structure on the space of complex structures. And this is the magic object. This didn't have to happen. It doesn't happen if you don't have a natural Kähler or hyperKähler structure. It only happens if your metric is genuinely hyperKähler or Bernoulli Kähler. In four dimensions, the integrability corresponds to the vanishing of the of half the Weyl tensor, which is basically what I call self-duality. All right. So that's the summary. The twisted space also has a natural real structure that is induced by the natural anticaudal map on the sphere fibers. That's not that important, but that's what it's saying. You'll find all these words when you go and read Hitchin's papers. Okay. So, let's see. Now, I'll tell you, this is not all. There's a correspondence, like a varied correspondence between data on twisted space, complex algebraic data, and the data of the metric on space-time. So this correspondence basically starts by noting that this beautiful result by Hitchin, which shows that the canonical bundle has a square root, and there's a natural correspondence between data on twisted space that lives in sections of that square root and metric data on space-time. So let me draw a table. Lay down the manifold and lay down PT. The most basic thing is that You don't need to know the manifold to start with. You can reconstruct the points of the manifold from the data of certain pseudo-holomorphic curves in actually holomorphic curves. So you have points x in the manifold. They correspond to certain rational curves, which are the node Lx embedded in PP that are preserved by the involution that I mentioned earlier. And the normal bundle L1 to the 2k. That, this correspondence constructs the points of spacetime from data on business space, from curves in business space. It sort of harkens back to these old fashioned theories where people wanted to find a completely auxiliary spacetime to encode the data of spacetime. So Penrose and friends just wanted to get rid of spacetime completely. So they constructed an auxiliary space that they called Pfister space, and completely algebraic data on Pfister space could give rise to your points of spacetime. Unfortunately, it only worked in these very special cases of Patrick-Kehler and Patrick-Kehler. The data of the metric itself is contained in a bunch of data. If the metric is hyperkähler, then the Pfister space has a holomorphic vibration over CP1 with a fiber-wise canonical bundle square root valued symplectic form. So usually it's known as capital sigma, and sometimes it's known as Gindikin's 2 form, because Gindikin found it in the context of 4 dimensions. The data of the Quaternion-Kähler metric, on the other hand, is encoded in a very natural contact structure. Sorry, minus half. It's a minus half. If you have a Quaternion-Kähler metric, then instead of a fiber-wise symplectic form, you actually get a contact form. And these are holomorphic symplectic forms and holomorphic contact forms. How, again, valued in KPD. And this is the data that you can use to construct sigma models into these spaces. So if you remember, sigma models like spring will sheet models work by pulling back something like a metric or a Kähler form back to the world from the target space to the world sheet. This is the data that you can geometrically use to construct sigma models, kind of beta gamma type models into a system. Any question about the review?
Oh. I have a basic question.
Yeah.
Is this correspondence true only for hyperkähler and quaternion-kähler? Can't we have a Calabi-Yau manifold of 4k or something?
No, this requires holonomy inside SPK because it requires the existence of a triplet IJK to get this via bundles. In general, Calabi-Yau, I don't think that's in 4 dimensions, Calabi-Yau coincides with the hyperkähler. So, end of the space function. Anyway. So let's construct some match. Let me just give you the basic idea, general idea, and then we'll construct some examples of these chiral algebras. All right. Any more questions? The idea is very simple. You simply try to write a world sheet like model. So you start with CP1 and consider maps. You can use some coordinates in your target space. So suppose PP has some holomorphic coordinates or any choice of coordinates you like. Let's say little vi. I'm going to use little vi as something else. Call them little vi. From CP1 to PD, you can consider maps like this. We have VI are coordinates on PD.
Are the coordinates just in the fibers?
No.
I'll get to the special cases in a minute. In the hypothetical case, they will reduce to Gordon simplified. At the moment, I'm doing both cases like simultaneously. Anyway, so suppose there are some holomorphic coordinates. In holomorphic coordinates, you can write, you can adapt the holomorphic coordinates to be double coordinates with either with respect to either your contact form or your symplectic form, or you don't need to. It's up to you. The general idea is that in the Dunning Taylor case, you have a contact form. Suppose sigma is a coordinate on the CP1, we have the coordinates in target. You don't even need to consider, you don't even need to think about PN. You simply write the action. I forgot to say what lambda was in that. Lambda is the cosmological constant. Or in the math literature, it's also known as the Einstein constant, because Claude likes it. Anyway, this is the cosmological constant. Okay. So, in this case, in the Kirchhoff-Taylor case, the action of this parallelogram basically looks like you take your contact form, you have a very natural object that's valued in KPT minus half. You basically think of these as maps with conformal weight half zero with respect to the CP1, or valued in, or like O minus one value with respect to the domain CP1. And then you can show that this is like a well-defined action, it has the right transformation.
So your contact form is a one form considered by k minus half?
Yes.
And then you're secretly pulling it back, but you didn't write
by
sigma.
By O minus one value.
But you didn't write sigma star.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's the CP1 is now embedded inside my target. If you like, I can put a, yeah, I did give it a name, otherwise. Anyway, this is the pullback. And this is like the general idea of constructing sigma models. You take some geometric structure, which is preferably a two-form or a one-form, and you pull it back. In the hypothetical case, you instead have a fiberwise symplectic form. So now you only need fiberwise coordinates. I'm going to show you explicitly how this happens when I take lambda to zero. But at the end of the day, coherently speaking, all you need to do is locally find a symplectic potential, which I'm going to call var theta because I like that weird thing. You just find a symplectic potential. Again, it'll be a fiberwise symplectic potential, and write the same action, and it does the same thing.
So this is what people call symplectic bosons, right?
These are just going to be symplectic bosons in coordinates. Just wanted to give a rough idea if everyone else forgets the rest of it. Yeah.
Sorry, dumb question. What letter is that? Is that a zeta?
No, that's a var thing.
No, no, sorry, above in the QK case.
This?
D sigma wedge, yeah.
Tau.
Tau, okay,
tau
sorry.
Is my contact.
Okay, yeah.
let me draw a picture, I guess. So, as I was saying, in the hypothetical case, this is phase of vibration, E1, and then there's a fiberwise symplectic form that sort of lives on just copies of the fibers, labor by some coordinate sigma on the base. And in this case, you don't have any vibration-like structure. You can have the randomish twist state, but you still have this beautiful globally defined contact. I think the contact form might be attributed to Ward, and more recently, more mathematically, to Calvert Eastwood. I think I'll attribute it to Ward and Penrose. In higher dimensions, I don't really, probably just Salomon. Anyway, so this is the rough idea. Is the rough idea clear? You take a geometric object. There are some very natural geometric objects available on twisted space for you to construct these parallelograms that are not available on space time. These are only available on twisted space. And so you go to twisted space and you try to write 2D things. You want to do things like holography. You want to find some beautiful lower dimensional theory that computes stuff for you. And that sort of gives you like an obvious thing that you would like to try. And at least in four dimensions, if I get time, I'll show that this action
we'll compute gravitational scattering amplitudes when written on flat space. That's the end goal, right? And we call these twisted sigma models, though my supervisor has started to hate me for not writing the word chiral sigma models. And, these are basically going to be beta now systems. Okay, let's do the main example. Is that a clock? Is that running? That is running. Let's do the example. The main source and example of this instruction comes from starting with flat space. Well, going to your manifold, working locally in a flat patch, writing the twisted space of flat space, and then deforming its complex structure to get a to get an interesting twisted space that would correspond to a hyperkähler non-prior. So for flat space is just R4k and the flat metric delta. The twisted space for flat space is usually denoted just mat dvpt. And this is a copy of cp 2k plus 1 minus a specific copy of cp 2k minus 1 xi. And you can show that this is the same as O1 to the 2k of cp 1. What one generically does is one introduces homogeneous coordinates on CP 2k plus 1, ZA, where A runs from 1 to k plus 2. And one decomposes it into fiber coordinates along the O1 directions, mu alpha dot, but alpha dot runs from 1 dot all the way up to 2k dot. The dot is a sad physics convention. Sorry about that. And the coordinates along the base CP1. So these are homogeneous coordinates. And since O1 transforms the same way as CP2k plus 1, we can use homogeneous coordinates on CP2k plus 1 as coordinates on O1 to the 2. And this is a very natural thing. In these coordinates, you can construct examples of all these objects. So the flat metric is, of course, like the Kähler. And you can construct the xi cp1, the xi cp2k minus 1 there corresponds to the locus where both lambda alphas would be 0. We remove that unit vibration of cp1. Anyway, so now you can construct examples of all of these structures that are listed in the table. Basically, you get a simplex. You have a vibration, as I've written there. The fibers are in fibers of 1 to 2k. You get a very natural symplectic form for which the Poisson bracket looks something like this. You can define a fiberwise Poisson bracket. Actually, before doing fiberwise, let me do the quaternion Kähler case. In the quaternion Kähler case, you can define a weighted contact form, but the weighted contact form can also be used to give you a weighted Poisson bracket. So basically what I'm doing here is I'm defining a Poisson bracket on twisted space for functions or not P forms, and this matrix IAB is going to consist of the natural SPK and SP1 invariance Q forms. So there's an SPK invariance Q form epsilon, and then in front of the SP1 invariance Q form I'm going to put a factor of lambda. What that ensures is that as I take lambda to 0, that's the hyperkähler limit. In that limit, the SP1 will be coupled. Okay. And this inverse matrix is defined to satisfy IAB, IAC equals IAC. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to start with this. Yeah, so when lambda goes to 0, you get a Poisson bracket on the fibers only, because it only differentiates along the mu directions. So that gives you a flat spacey example of all those constructions. Now we'll start constructing a non-trivial curved example. So how do you do it? The simplest way is to start with such a flat model and then deform around it. So the deformation is going to be a deformation of complex structure. You take the d bar operator of PT and you define a new d bar operator that, instead of the generic Bertrami differential, we're going to use the symplectic or the contact structure and define a derivative using the Poisson product. So a generic complex structure of interest is going to be what is called a Hamiltonian complex structure deformation, where the Hamiltonian will now have weight. It'll be a one form valued in OCT, where O2 is in the sense of CT2. This gives you, if H satisfies a specific integrability condition, then this gives rise to an integrable complex structure on Fischer space, and then that gives rise in turn to a Fermionic Hilbert metric on space time. And this is a classical theorem. Yeah. I haven't actually looked into the use of I'm not entirely sure about this fully. It's in coordinates, I don't know if anyone proved it before us. In general, it's no. If the following integrability condition is satisfied, then you can show that the following contact deformed contact form, tau, that you define by writing half IAB CABZB minus H is holomorphic. It turns out that these two are basically equivalent conditions. This is naturally over two valued. I didn't say it, but the canonical bundle. Why did I say KP to the half? It must be KP to the K or something. It has to be O2 value. Maybe I made a mistake, but sorry. Too late. Anyway. This is the object that we want. This is the Poisson bracket. If H was 0, then this would generate this contact structure would generate the weighted Poisson bracket that I wrote above. And now the non-triviality is in the deformation. And as the theorem that this condition, if the complex structure is integrable, then that object is holomorphic. And now you can use that holomorphic object to construct the metric. I'm not going to do that. That's like a procedure that you can go and look at in the papers. Let me get to the new stuff about the construction of the chiral algebra. The chiral algebra is now very easily constructed. Just give this ZA, turn this into a field, and write the first action that comes to mind. Half integral d sigma, which z dot d bar z, let me write it in clarity, d bar z v minus h. And there's a factor of cosmological constant that I want. So this is the chiral algebra that we call the sigma model. And this has a nice property that this computes the Swan structure of space.
Can I just parse this for a sec?
So
you're running over all coordinates, not fiber coordinates, because you're in the
quaternion, Kaelic, yes.
So it's really a sigma model.
This is a...
As opposed to a section of a bundle.
Yes.
I see.
Yeah. Well, that's uncalled the whole thing sigma model. This is a chiral sigma.
I have a question. So is a lambda investigation still a constant, cosmological constant, right?
That is the cosmological constant. This is the wedge product.
It's
some quote. Actually, in math, they call it little lambda, but little lambda means something else. So, Little lambda is a
okay.
Some other question? Is that okay?
I'm just going to try to parse. I mean, so in...
Just to pull back again.
So in the case of, like, CT3, right?
Yes.
Then there's three coordinates, and there's no way of writing down a non-degenerate quadratic one. Kinetic term means. Because the coordinates have to be paired.
Yes.
So this is kind of degenerate in the case of CP3?
CP...
It's an ordinary twister space of or 4.
Yeah.
Right, so twister space is a three-dimensional manifold.
Yeah.
So I have a chiral theory with three fields.
Yes.
If I want to write down a kinetic term, I need a symplectic structure on that space of three fields, which there isn't.
Well, that's why you use this. I mean, I haven't actually tried expanding this in affine coordinates, but I think you'll get through. Well, IAB has a component along each of the directions. You probably get some action that sort of mixes the three coordinates together.
So I suspect it's something like if I took my z's to be a point, then
no, you're right.
It would be bad.
You can't write it in that.
So it's not really a sigma model. It's only for embedded curves.
It only works for works in the non-projective sense. Yeah,
it's like a green Schwarz string, as opposed to the ornate strings.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. To be precise, it's only works for the treating these as non-projective coordinates. Yeah. Just to be safe. But the equation of motion of this curve actually. Well, it actually works in the projective sense as well because the weights are correct. Because z has weight half zero, and the sigma transformation cancels its weight at the end of the day.
So it's like
I have to write in homogeneous coordinates, it probably makes sense.
If you wanted to write it, a sigma model
yeah.
in non-projective coordinates and then make it projective, you somehow have to do a BRST reduction by the C star action.
Yeah, so here we don't do that. We didn't seem to need to do that. So secretly, this is working in the Quaternion-Kellogg case is working in the non-projective case. And actually, there's a good reason for that.
Okay.
This is computing the Kähler potential of a hyperkähler metric on non-projective twister space. So projective twister space is not mod 4, this
yes.
dimension, but non-projective twister space has a dimension mod 4. And
mm-hmm.
it's actually it's at least Kähler, I forget if it's hyperkähler. There's a natural Kähler structure on it called the Swan Kähler structure.
Okay.
And you're right, this one strictly lives there and computes data of that non-projective nature. It's just that data is homogeneous again, so you can, once you have that, you can sort of restrict it to any slice, compute space-time.
Okay.
Sorry, H is background or dynamical?
H is my background, so now I've sort of deformed my... H is like the gravitational field in four dimensions. In four dimensions, H will literally become a self-dual graviton, a positive helicity graviton field. But here, H is just the data of the hyperkähler Quaternion-Kähler metric encoded in the data of some complex structure deformation on twister space. All right, so let me skip over some things. As usual, I hope that was much too long. Let me just say in verse that when you compute the equation of the way we guessed this as the object of interest is that the equation of motion of this 2D system computes gives you the equation, the Cauchy-Riemann equations that are satisfied by holomorphic curves. And if H is integrable, in general of pseudo-holomorphic curves, if H is integrable, then it gives you, well, it's easy enough to write down the equation of motion on the slide. IAB dBH, the not one part of this with respect to the CP1 complex fraction equal 0. And this gives you holomorphic, this is the equation of holomorphic maps, or holomorphic maps from CP1. Salomon, MacDuff, and Salomon, and check that this is true. Now let's see how to get the hyperkähler case. The hyperkähler case is very similar. You just take a lambda going to zero limit. Hyperkähler case, you take lambda going to zero. Basically, expand the IAB explicitly in the dotted and undotted indices. So you get, at first,
because of the lambda factor in the 1 over 2 lambda up front, you get a action that looks like d sigma 1 over 2 lambda epsilon alpha beta lambda alpha d bar lambda beta plus half an action along the mu directions minus h. Oh, this should be a factor of lambda. Apologies for that. And then when you take the lambda going to zero limit, this dynamically localizes on sections. Basically, you have a lambda going to zero limit here, which tells you that as lambda goes to zero, the saddle point approximation tells you that d bar lambda beta has to be zero. So lambda beta, the curves have to align with the vibration of crystal space that I mentioned earlier. And I can just say that lambda beta is, lambda beta is an O minus one valued field, so the natural parameterization happens to look something like that. Okay, good. And this gives you the hyperkähler case of the twisted sigmoidal.
Can I ask one more question?
Yeah.
We can write down an action like that as a sigmoidal with target any holomorphic symplectic manifold. But you want to do it for sections of a bundle of holomorphic symplectic manifolds. So isn't it a bit strange when the symplectic form is the twisting by k to the minus half the kind of correct one? Like, I'm getting a bit confused. O minus one would have been the correct one.
Yeah. So this, what happens is, this scales up when you scale lambda, but lambda scales down when you scale sigma. And so it scales the same way with respect to this measure. Let's do it in homogeneous coordinates.
Then you can say, like, if I had a section of O1 plus O1,
yeah,
because O1 plus O1 squared is k to the minus 1, not k to the plus 1, I would force my section to have zeros.
It's exactly, yeah. But now I'm giving you a field that has no, it's going to be a section of O minus 1. It's not going to have any global section, but it'll have sections with poles, and I'll come to the story of the defects and the poles in a bit.
Okay.
I'm trying, what I realized while writing this talk is that you don't need to begin with defects. You can add them, but there's a universal bit of the theory that you can start with, and you can add a variety of defects to this to compute different things. So if you, let me just get to that.
Yeah.
Let me come to the main theorem that we proved. Again, this theorem in the sense of physicists, I do not claim to have done any any analysis. So everything is in the smooth category. I'm going to solve the PDE, but it's going to be in the smooth category. When Lionel gives this talk, Lionel's on a sabbatical, and he gave the same kind of talk at CNRS or something, and people were actually asking about, what is the smoothness condition? Yes, everything is valid in the smooth category, at least in the second differentiable, twice differentiable category. Anyway. So, let's see. The main result, due to lack of time, let me just state the main result for the hyperkähler case. The quaternion kähler case, as I just said in words, gives rise to a kähler potential on the Swan bundle, which is like the non-projective twisted space. I think it's the same thing as a hyperkähler cone over twisted space, but I haven't checked. But let me give you the result for the hyperkähler case. Basically, take your CP1 world sheet. Let me just call it a world sheet. Pick a particular point, zeta in CP1. Couple the twisted sigma model, couple the model to antipodally placed defects at sigma equals zeta minus 1 over zeta bar to write the action S equals integral. Well, let me call that action S subscript H of mu. You take that action as your universal bit and you compute this object, omega of z z hat equals zeta plus 1 over zeta bar. There are some numerical factors that don't really matter much. The action, basically start with the action, couple it to a pair of sources living at these two points. This is very much like Polyakov's trick. Minus 1 over zeta bar. Take the action, couple it to two antibodily placed sources, and then compute this action on shell. So basically, if you compute the on-shell action, you reproduce a quantity. The z alpha dot and z hat alpha dot are basically defect fields. You can say they're just constants. They're just some parameters. But they're going to provide complex coordinates in a specific complex structure on my hyperkähler spacetime. And then when you compute this object through the on-shell action, through this coupled on-shell action, then this will provide a Kähler potential for the hyperkähler Ricci flat metric. You can show that there is a PDE. The Ricci flatness condition gives rise to a non-linear PDE on omega, and this provides a completely non-linear solution of that problem, at least in principle. It's basically formal manipulation, just calculation. You can show that if h satisfies d bar h plus, well, if h satisfies d bar plus h squared equals zero, then this provides a solution of the Ricci flatness condition. It provides a Kähler, a hyperkähler metric. This provides a Kähler form of a Kähler potential hyperkähler. So a similar story for the Swan scalar, which you can sort of take a slice of space-time inside vector space and get a quaternion Kähler metric. But I'm going to avoid that. So basically, g equals d d bar omega, where d is dz alpha dot d by dz alpha dot gives a hyperkähler metric. Okay, good. This is the main theorem. What's its utility? The amplitude section is complicated, so instead of that, I'm going to do an example, and then if people will let me go onwards, I can go onwards. So let's do just the flat space example, R4K. How do you reproduce the flat space scalar potential should just be norm z squared. Oh, sorry, I forgot to say z hat here. Alpha dot is the, well, you take z, dotted on the right with, as a vector, dotted on the right with the SPK invariance Q form, z bar. Z hat is basically the complex conjugate of Z. It's just slightly mixed up, so it's basically a quaternionic conjugate. Anyway, you want to reproduce the flat space scalar potential from this. It's very easy. What do? In flat space, the sigma model, H equals zero, is just d sigma half mu alpha dot d bar mu beta dot epsilon alpha dot beta dot. You couple it to those defects, and then you vary and compute the solutions of the equation of motion. So the equation of motion is b bar u alpha dot equals pair of sources. You get z alpha dot, a delta function localized at sigma equals zeta, plus z hat alpha dot, a delta function localized at sigma at the antipodal point. This is very easy to solve. Again, Polyakov's trick. I'm neglecting the factors of 2 pi I now. Simply plug it back in here. The source term gets cancelled when you take d bar. It basically generates the factor of delta bars and cancels the source terms. And then since the action is quadratic in mu's, what's left is quadratic in the z's, and it happens to be exactly 1 over, well, you set sigma to 1 over zeta bar inverse, and you get zeta plus zeta bar inverse in the denominator that cancels with that normalization, and you get exactly the Kähler potential of the Platt metric. And my claim is that this works in general. But it's like a longish calculation. I'm not gonna give you the proof. It's actually just a calculation following what is well established in the Penrosian literature. But yeah, okay. How is this useful? Let me just give you a summary of how is this useful for computing scattering amplitudes. Any questions until now?
One question, Philip. This should also work in the scalar flat case, in at least
in the scalar flat case. In the scalar flat case, we don't have a differential form.
We have a Meromorphic volume form. Isn't that enough to define the action? It's like gives us a symplectic form transverse to the curve.
A symplectic form transverse to the curve.
The curve each one needs one leg, and then there's.
You're right, you could try something like d sigma bar hook omega, something like that. Yeah. I don't know if that's very, maybe that isn't a, the, one of the things, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Take an arbitrary off-shell curve, write this down. If the equation of motion gives you something reasonable, like the, it says that the curve is holomorphic, then maybe you're on the right track. I actually haven't tried this, but, yeah, it might be right, because we know that there's a formula for the Kähler form in the scalar flat case, which is a contour integral of omega. Now, maybe there's a direct way to get the Kähler potential. In this case, this directly gives the Kähler potential, which is like the nicer thing to have.
Right. Yeah. Well, we know in the Brin space, basically, we do know that the Kähler potential, I think.
Okay. Well, we know the answer because Claude Lebrun worked very hard to find it. Okay, so just for summary of the physics part, summary of results on amplitude. Basically, what happened was that, obviously, I'm a physicist. I did not embark on the most general possible hyperkähler geometry just to come out with a paper that doesn't say anything about the real world. That's what Lyle does. But yeah, okay. So the result was as follows. There's an action for GR that goes by the name of Lebansky action. And there's a version of it that was developed by Lee Smolin, Ted Jacobson, and all these people. That version roughly looks something like this. It's got it's got some two forms in it. Let me not write it down. It's got some two forms that are called anti-self dual two forms that encode the data of the metric on spacetime. And it's got some version of a connection. Now we're in 4D. It's got a version of the spin connection that encodes basically the Levi-Civita connection of the metric, at least on shell. It's a first order form. Just a rough outline. There's something, it looks like a phase-based type action. There are two canonically conjugate variables. This encodes the metric. These are actually two forms with some indices here. This encodes the connection. The Levi-Civita connection on shell, and then there's an interaction vertex which looks something like sigma wedge gamma wedge gamma. And alpha and beta are now two comparator indices. The MHV amplitude is computed by this object. That's what generates. Oh yeah, MHV amplitudes are basically they stand for maximally helicity violating, but at the end of the day, they mean two negative helicity gravitons. And say n minus 2 plus helicity gravitons. Are people roughly familiar? Okay, good. This amplitude is basically computed by that sigma gamma gamma term because you can treat the gammas as negative helicity modes and sigma as encoding all the positive helicity modes. So at the end of the day, the calculation becomes to compute, to solve for some classical background that's sourced by all the positive velocity gravitons, and then compute the, at tree level, the amplitude is computed by just computing the on-shell interaction vertex, sigma, gamma, gamma. And we showed, again, by basically straightforward formal manipulations, you can gauge fix to adapt So I should say that self-duality corresponds, self-dual Ricci flat backgrounds that correspond to positive helicity sources basically correspond to the hyperkähler backgrounds in general dimensions. So now when I say positive helicity, I just mean the hyperkähler case again. And now what I can do is I have to choose a set of complex coordinates, and I can choose the complex coordinates z and z hat to be adapted to the, well, they corresponded to a choice of zeta. What I can do is, instead of taking zeta and zeta bar inverse antipodally, I can take one of them to be the spinner helicity data of one of my negative helicity gravitons, and the other one to be the spinner helicity data of the other negative helicity gravitons. And then you can show, as we showed in our paper, that in this gauge fixing, once you've gauge fixed in gravity, you can compute form factors. And this connects back to the stuff that Kevin and Natalie did in their Yang-Mills case. In Yang-Mills, you don't need to gauge fix because you have local gauge invariant operators. In gravity, you have to gauge fix to get local gauge invariant operators. And the correct object whose form factor reproduces the on-shell sigma gamma gamma term, basically you can show that on-shell this reduces to an integral of a Kähler potential. So if particles 1 and 2 are negative helicity, and P1 and P2 is the data of their momenta, then you can show, and omega contains only a metric sourced by particles 3 up to n, which are positive helicity, then you can show that this form factor of omega, well, yeah, I put the integral, but you can compute just the form factor of omega, and that will give rise to what is known as a Hodge's formula for MHV graviton amplitudes. You might have heard about Park-Taylor formula in the Yang-Mills case. In the gravitational case, omega form factor, which again you compute using that theorem, you can compute omega using that, gives Hodges formula, named after Andrew Hodges, who's still very much alive and comes to Oxford sometimes. He's also a gay rights activist. Anyway, so, Hodges formula for MHV amplitudes. I am not going to write down this formula, but you can ask for Chaza and friends who found a beautiful generalization of Hodges formula beyond the case of just taking two negative velocity gravitons. The generalization, okay, yeah. Just to say, omega can be computed through the on-shell action. If you're familiar with basic quantum field theory tricks, then the on-shell action of a theory is computed by certain Feynman diagrams, and those Feynman diagrams can be tree-level Feynman diagrams, and those Feynman diagrams basically assemble into correlation functions of the chiral algebra given by the mu's. The OPs of the mu's can be read off from just the free field bit, and then H here can be used as interaction vertices to compute those Feynman diagrams. It basically reduces the computation to a 2D computation, which is very nice, and which is sort of what we want in a holographic, lower dimensional interpretation of quantum gravity. Well, okay, so going beyond MHV has proven very hard. I was hoping I could get that and show you that example, but I don't want to. Yeah, it's already time. So let's finish up, and then if anyone's interested, I can discuss it later. Thanks.